From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Like everyone around this time of year, I get into a looking back while looking ahead combined mindset. Today I want to do just that, but with a sort of ecological filter, taking stock of how things in the garden fared in the bigger environmental picture and what opportunities lie ahead for me to read nature's signals even more closely and be an ever better steward of the place. Who better to talk about that with than my guest, Uli Lorimer, Director of Horticulture at Native Plant Trust, the nation's oldest plant conservation organization. So more in a moment with him, but first these messages.
Underwriting support for Away to Garden comes from Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs for landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at colorblends.com. Season your spring with Color Blends this fall. Also from High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, featuring 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project certified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com.
Uli Lorimer, author of The Northeast Native Plant Primer, has made native plants his life's work. In 2019, he became director of horticulture at Native Plant Trust, which was founded in 1900 as the New England Wildflower Society. Previously, he was longtime curator of the Native Flora Garden at Brooklyn Botanic Garden. Hi, Uli, how are you?
I'm wonderful. I'm such a delight to be back on the show.
Yeah, happy almost New Year. Who knows what?
So hard to tell these days.
I know. Before we start, I should say we'll have a giveaway of your wonderful book, The Northeast Native Plant Primer, with the transcript of the show over on awaytogarden.com. And so, you know, what a crazy feeling year here for me. And I'm sort of across Massachusetts over the New York border from you. And, you know, but it's the same place I've been in for decades. And this might sound familiar to people. You know, I've been here a long time, but it felt sort of unrecognizable. You know, relentless amounts of rain. I had my first spongy moth infestation ever, jumping worms at epic levels.
Yes.
No real winter yet, even though we're really nearing the end of the year. And all capped off by the USDA's new hardiness zone map that moves me once again a half a zone warmer. So I'd love to start with your feedback as a native plant focused person on the new map, for instance, because that's kind of timely.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say I was surprised to see the zones inch up a little bit more, and I think it's just another way of marking that climate change is real and it's here. And you know, if you look at the longer period of time, you know, let's say the last few decades, you can see how dramatically those ranges have shifted. I feel like the news is mostly met with a positive note, and folks thinking, boy, I can grow more tender perennials now and different things that maybe weren't fully hardy in our zone now. But I had a slightly different reaction, and I thought about plants that really like cold conditions and things that need you know, deep cold winters. And I'm thinking of all of the sort of lovely plants that you could find just across the Hudson River up in the Catskills, for example. So, you know, balsam fir forests that only exist currently above, you know, 3,500 feet. Those plants are struggling. You know, you mentioned it being one of the wettest records on wettest years on record, and that came on the heels of a pretty droughty year the year before.
Yes.
And for those forests and those plant communities and all those sort of lovely little treasures that reside within, you know, they're getting squeezed off the top of the mountain, and that's concerning.
And it's not just things at high elevation either. Aren't there other plants as well that have cold requirements to be successful and thrive? I mean, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, back when I was at Brooklyn Botanic Garden, we were doing the New York Metropolitan Flora Project, which is sort of a 30-year look at changes in floristics in a you know, major metropolitan area. And there were records of Cornus canadensis, bunchberry, which is another one of these really beautiful, you know, herbaceous ground covers, last being seen in northern New Jersey in the 1920s.
Yes.
And then now completely extirpated and gone. If we fast forward maybe another 50 years, it may also be extirpated from the Catskills if this trend continues.
Right.
And it also makes it harder for, native plant enthusiasts to grow those plants in a garden setting. Here at Garden in the Woods, we do grow it, but I don't think we grow it as well as it does, in habitat in those mountainous regions. And it tends to struggle. Particularly, I feel like the issue is not so much cold, but also warm, humid summer nights that these plants don't like. So, it has effect across all of that suite of plants that you usually associate with more northern and colder climates.
And it's not just here. There are examples just like those two in every region of the country that will or won't acclimate as well or thrive in the evolving conditions, even though they were, quote, native, that it's their traditional range, that they're not going to be as happy as things shift. It's complicated. It's very complicated.
Certainly. The other thing which is, complicated and concerning and depressing, and, would love to get all that out at the beginning of the show.
Let's be depressed. Yay! Happy New Year!
has to do with pest pressures. You mentioned spongy moth.
Yes.
And so, with milder winters and not cold winters, it allows for more of those pest organisms to overwinter, to survive. In some cases, things like southern pine beetle might even be able to turn over two generations in a single season. And I was just talking to a good friend, Rodney Eason, who worked in Acadia for many, many years, and mentioned that hemlock woolly adelgid is just beginning to show up there.
In Maine.
In Maine. So, the iconic Acadia National Park, it's just beginning to show up, and largely due to the fact that the winters are getting milder and milder, and those organisms are not getting killed off by the, minus 10, minus 20 degree periods that used to be the normal.
Yes. I keep thinking about snow cover and how, growing up in the northeastern region, that we had persistent snow cover for weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks, if not months. And then that's gradually changed. And I keep thinking about, this is a complete derailment, sorry, but you know how I am, how my brain works. But I keep thinking about the subnivian layer, that sort of little layer between the soil, the ground surface, and the bottom of the snow, and all the creatures that in the winter utilize that area. And I keep thinking, but it doesn't exist. Where are they all? What are they doing? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. I love that term, by the way, subnivian. It's just such a wonderful word. No, but not just where do those organisms exist without snow cover, but you lose the insulating effect of the snow.
Yes.
And you get more of that sort of frost thaw cycle with the soil, and more heaving, and it really disrupts that entire winter ecosystem when we don't have consistent snow period and snow cover.
Because it had an insulating. It was an insulator, right? As you're saying,
If folks are interested, there's a really wonderful researcher named Elizabeth Berkowski, I think out of University of New Hampshire, rather, who studies exactly these winter effects on climate change, and what's happening with the decreased snow cover, and she's got some really wonderful research. So
Good tip. I'll get a link for the transcript for thank you.
She's really wonderful.
Well, another topic that was probably on the minds of gardeners throughout the country as they closed out the 2023 garden, and some are still doing that right now, and that will be on our minds again as we all look ahead to starting, for 2024, is sort of the ethic of gentler care of the garden, especially at those both ends, the so-called cleanups that used to be so fastidious, like such control and domination over all the plants. And the call in recent years with ecology in mind has been to leave the leaves and so on. So, there's more and more awareness of that gentler approach, which speaks to a greater, environmental awareness in general for gardeners. But, so looking ahead, looking back and looking ahead, like what at Native Plant Trust at your properties, Have you shifted, or did you always, quote, leave the leaves? Or, you know, what's the, both at the fall end and at the spring end, the waking up, going to sleep and waking up ends of the garden, what's the guidance, and what do you see change that has changed recently, or ahas you've had?
Well, for us, I think we, you know, because the garden in the woods is, you know, in the woods, so we have to manage a lot of leaves. And so I think that we tend to let them lay where they fall for the most part, although we do in the Curtis woodland, we've got fairly extensive plantings of phlox divaricata and phlox stolonifera, so different, you know, creeping and woodland phlox. And we found that leaving the leaf cover over the winter is not a detriment to the plants. But they do need to be uncovered a little bit in the springtime. And so that ends up, you know, again, it's sort of like protection and insulation for them. And, you know, believe it or not, there's enough light that filters through. So they still are able to photosynthesize. But then those are areas that we try to lightly rake free a little bit ahead of, you know, spring growth. Otherwise, you know, paying attention to where leaves naturally accumulate, both areas where, you know, maybe little swales or trying to plan for plants that don't mind deep leaf litter. So, you know, if it's an area that will accumulate maybe 8 or 12 inches of leaves over the winter, we're going to put things like Solomon seal or ferns or something that have strong enough growth that they can push through all of that leaf litter, and they don't seem to mind. On the flip side of that, what we've been doing quite a bit, which I really like, is finding spots where, you know, prevailing wind patterns keep the ground bare and where moss naturally grows. And we try to help that along and kind of keep those moss patches going. And they end up being the really perfect place to display what botanists like to call belly plants, things you need to get down on your belly to see. So
belly plants. I love
yes.
that.
so things like, you know, houstonias, things like partridge berry or trailing arbutus, you know, these really delicate, wonderful spring, you know, spring charmers that would just be utterly lost and smothered if the leaf litter got to be too heavy.
So you're reading the landscape then for clues on places that can accommodate these little treasures. Is that?
Well, if you think of it this way, that, you know, let's say you really want to have a planting of bluettes in a place, you can set yourself up to, you know, sort of forever maintenance to keep clearing that space of leaves or shredding it and add extra tasks, or work with what the landscape is telling you and shift your planting designs and plans to, you know, eliminate, you know, busy work. In other words, like, you don't have to keep fussing over this one little spot because, you know, the winds keep it clear and the bluettes just seed themselves into the moss and
right. So this is, yeah. So this and into midwinter and so forth would be a good time to maybe go out and take some notes and observe and write down where those places are in your landscape that nature, the wind patterns, because the topography and so forth and the prevailing winds seems to leave cleaner.
Yeah.
That's interesting. I never really thought about that, but now I'm mental image I'm having of like, oh, right, that's where all my leaves always accumulate, but I don't have any over there, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, so the other thing, the flip side of that too, is to say that, you know, if you're clearing your leaves from the lawn and, you know, to go back to what you were saying earlier about the Leave the Leaves campaign, I think there is, for some people, it looks unkempt or untidy if you don't do anything. And I think there's a middle ground that where you can still embrace these ecological intentions and techniques and have a garden that looks like you're caring for it. And so where I'm driving with this is that, many people are creatures of habit. So they do the same thing every year, and maybe you blow your leaves into the same shrub every year. Mm-hmm. And I think that we should, you know, you should take a look at that practice and say, like, am I burying this thing, you know, year after year, or does it not care? Is it okay? Mm-hmm. You know, I see driving around, sometimes I see some of the lawn services, and homes that abut woods, they're just blowing the leaves right into the woods. And I think that accumulation of leaf litter can be bad for some plants. It certainly is the right kind of habitats for jumping worms to get a foothold into. For us here at the garden, we had an area that used to be really populated with a lot of mountain laurels, and they were in decline when I arrived, and I was trying to figure out why. And so I began to dig around at the base of the shrubs, only to find that they had been buried under, you know, 12 to 14 inches of leaf mold.
Oh.
And it made sense when I was like, oh, because the way the path goes here, we just blow off the leaves into the beds every right. year in the same spot, in the same spot. And the shrubs were really in decline because of that. And so now we've shifted our practices and we rake those and put them somewhere else. And the laurel seemed to be making a recovery. So it was another little like aha moment of, you know, maybe be a little critical about how you do your maintenance and if you're doing the same thing every year, and pay attention and observe. I think those are the, you know, the two things that gardeners do really well.
Another I call it a trend, but in recent years that I see more and more and people ask me about and I hear friends doing and experimenting with more is growing things from seed, especially native plants, because a lot of times the ones you're seeking aren't necessarily available at anywhere near you. You know, it's, I can buy in from some of the famous longtime purveyors of native plants who might be located in the Midwest or somewhere else. I can buy in things that technically are native in my region, you know, if I look at their range maps and so forth, but it's not really the local version, the local ecotype. It's not the local genetics, right? And so more and more people are saying, well, I really want to find the you know, this one that's really from here and that's, you know, adapted to here. And and I know you guys are involved in, you know, so what I'm saying is, like, I think people want native plants that are even more locally native, and they are frustrated, and so they're learning to grow them from seed and multiply their, you know, numbers of them. But I think you're doing that on a larger scale. You're involved with that on a larger scale.
Yeah, I mean, so a few comments to make. First, thank you for bringing up seeds, because I absolutely love them. I think it completes a full circle. You know, when I got into horticulture, you know, you get really attracted to plants and flowers, and then to seed heads, and then learning to collect seed and clean and grow them and see that same plant complete that full life circle is just really fulfilling and whole in a way. And I feel that many folks who decide to grow their own from seed experience that same joy and fulfillment of like, hey, I took this tiny little thing and I sowed it outside and covered it for the winter. And then this magic happened in the springtime. And I got, you know, out of a packet of seeds, I got hundreds of plants.
Yes.
And it's so much more economical that way. And it connects people on a much deeper level to their gardens when they can say, hey, I grew that from seed and look at it now. Now it's spreading. And now I know how to collect that seed and share it with my neighbors, or, you know, cast it about or grow more. I think it's a really wonderful activity. And so there's some really great folks, and we spoke about this before, the folks at the Wild Seed Project in Portland, Maine, have really fantastic resources on how to do winter sowing and kind of slow gardening. And it's, they take a lot of the sort of mystery out of it, but none of the magic. And I think that's
right.
It's a great resource. So hopefully we can link to
I will resources. Do that. I'll to some downloadable resources that people can get from Wild Seed Project in Maine. And, you know, and it's not a lot of fancy equipment. It's letting nature provide the chill period that's required for a lot of these native plants to then eventually germinate. And, you know, it's low tech. It's just the timing and protecting them from rodents. So the rodents don't eat your seed.
Yeah,
that's the big thing, but that's about it. So, but you're doing that. You're trying to help, again, you know, unless we collect locally from our own place, you know, that we have one plant and we want to have more plants. Sometimes it's hard to get the seed that's yep. a local ecotype, you know, yep. that's, yeah.
So we're involved in what's called the Northeast Seed Network. And this is a very new effort to address that lack of availability of seed in the Northeast. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're seeing this from sort of two different perspectives in that folks that are ecological restoration practitioners can't find the right kinds of materials to put back into wild places, you know, after, let's say, invasive species removal or mitigation projects. And then certainly the thirst for native plants from the horticulture side has just really exploded over the past couple of years. And it's hard to find plants, let alone seeds. So this effort is really aimed at building that supply chain so that we have more people growing plants for seed production, and that can then feed into nurseries that can grow more plants for folks to buy. And that can also supply the restoration industry at scale for the important work that they're doing as well. And so, you know, we have a lot of wonderful partners from Wild Seed Project, Smith College, Ecological Health Network, some of the local organic farming associations in Connecticut and New York, Hilltop Hanover Farm, closer down to where you are, and representatives of some nurseries as well, Pinelands, Planter's Choice, Van Berkom Nursery. You know, a lot of people are really recognizing that this type of supply chain and infrastructure is completely lacking in the Northeast. Right. And so we're taking steps to address that. And so right. it's not just the people collecting seed and growing it, but also we're building proper facilities to clean the seed and house it so that it can be made available throughout the year.
Yeah, well, I'll give link to information about that as well, about that work. It was originally someone at Cornell who told me about it, actually, that I learned about it from someone at Cornell University who does the Native Lawn Project there. He turned me on to it. So yeah, it sounds very interesting.
It's just getting started. And, you know, and I think that in the coming years, we're really going to be building out, you know, the supply chain, the market, all the educational and workshops and training materials and everything that goes with it.
Yeah.
So we're really excited about the potential impact that this can have for, you know, native plant enthusiasts and restoration practitioners in the Northeast.
So in the last 3-4 minutes, I just wanted to ask you for some looking ahead, you know, like what, you know, I mean, we all as gardeners, you know, we're all like, ooh, I really want to get this plant. I really want to get, are there plants that you think of as like the wish list plants of the next, you know, sort of the next wave, like that you'd love to see more people grow, or that you guys are increasing, you know, hoping to increase your stock of, or that you just want to put out there as like, hey, this is a really great plant? Because I think when a lot of us think native plant, you know, we go to the regular garden center, it's like, well, there's a purple coneflower, but yeah. A purple coneflower is, if you look at the map where it's native to, it's not native to most of our areas at all. No. You know, so like, I'm just wondering if, and again, people are in all different regions of the country who are listening, but, you know, I was just curious if there's something that you sort of lust after, you know, that you're hoping to see come to the, you know, to popularity or
well, whatever. I mean, I have I think that, you know, maybe this is, some people think of this as a boring answer, but I think sedges are really,
yes,
have so much utility. And I think we're just beginning to kind of scratch the surface of the ones that are commercially available. And they've got, you know, applications from, you know, sedges that grow in dry sand, all the way to ones that will grow in standing water and everything in between. And I think of them as sort of the like the glue of the matrix that ties together your, you know, your asters and your goldenrod and all the other sorts of, you know, more colorful plants. There are, you know, because we're also a conservation organization, you know, I'm always inherently interested in more unusual plants and rare plants. I think that we need to find a good way for gardeners to ethically have access to those kinds of plants. You know, and this is sort of a bigger conversation that has to involve you know, natural heritage bureaus and so forth. I think there needs to be a way that people can support plant conservation in their backyards, as well as supporting, you know, insects and wildlife and birds and butterflies with all of the common things as well. So, you know, that's something that I would love to try to advance those conversations next year, because there's some really wonderful plants that ought to be more available
right.
for folks to grow.
Right. Yeah, and then there's just things that grow that we have always grown, and we've all been digging them out for so long, and maybe we should give them a chance to stay a while. Like, I'm thinking of pokeweed. I have a magnificent specimen of pokeweed in my backyard right now. And, you know, for so many years, I pulled it all out. I dug it all out madly.
Yeah,
and it's fabulous,
it's
right?
It's tough to get rid of.
Right, but it's Do you know what I mean? I mean, the birds love it.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's the fruit has huge wildlife value, and you know, and I think I even remember there being a like a chartreuse selection at Wave Hill when I first started there, and I thought,
oh,
wow,
interesting.
Like, you know, this is a plant that most people would you know immediately rip out, and here they've recognized its aesthetic beauty, you know, and those hot pink, you know, fruit inflorescences.
Yeah,
and,
crazy.
You know,
I
was like, what a cool plant. And I was so glad they found a good way to use it. So,
well, Uli Lorimer, I'm always glad to talk to you, and happy whatever comes next. If we get a winter or not, we'll see. And I look forward to talking to you again in the new year.
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. And thanks to all of you for listening. Now, don't miss an episode. You can subscribe free to the podcast version of the show on Apple Podcasts or on Spotify. And you can find me anytime at awaytogarden.com and on Facebook and on Instagram as @awaytogarden. And happy gardening, especially with native plants, meantime.
Underwriting support for A Way to Garden comes from Color Blends Wholesale Flower Bulbs. Flower bulbs for landscape professionals and ambitious residential gardeners at colorblends.com. Season your spring with Color Blends this fall. Also from High Mowing Seeds, Wolcott, Vermont, featuring 30 new seed varieties for 2024. Professional quality vegetable, flower, and herbal seeds that are 100% organic and non-GMO project certified. On the web, highmowingseeds.com.
A Way to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.